To be sanctioned to be a pastor in the Presbyterian Church is quite an arduous process. You get poked and prodded and examined many, many times. You go through psychological testing. You meet with a committee from what's called our presbytery who kind of discern your maturity, your theological underpinnings, your sense of whether or not you are mature enough to be a pastor. You go to seminary for 3 years, and then you have to pass a bunch of tests, theology, polity, worship, and so on. You have to show that you can have some proficiency in a dead language, either biblical Greek or Hebrew. And then finally, the last step is you stand before about 100 people usually. They're called presbyters, elders, and pastors, who can ask you anything they want. It's a theological examination. And they can ask you about your understanding of baptism. They can ask you whether you think God can make a rock so big God can't lift it. They can ask you, you know, how can a loving God allow evil in the world? Anything that they want to ask you theologically to show that you can think theologically in a way that you are then released to preach in a congregation. I thought of all that rigmarole and testing that happens for those who want to be pastors as I was reading a story again in the Gospel of John where an impromptu theological examination takes place. Jesus is going to be examined by some folks who decide they want to put just one question to him. It's a profound story that has so many layers of meaning. I invite you again to open your hearts and to hear the story from John's Gospel. Early in the morning, Jesus came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery. And making her stand before all of them, they said, Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now, in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say? They said this to test him, so that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And once again, he bent down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the elders, and Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on, do not sin again." May God bless to our hearing and to our living this reading from God's holy word. Now, some of you might be having a case of deja vu, those who were here last Sunday or perhaps watched last week's service. This same passage was used, so you're not losing your mind. Decided to come back for a second shot at this. You know, sometimes TV shows will show an event from more than one perspective because there's so much there that might be gleaned. And so for those who have not heard the story last week, the basic premises that we have just heard is that there's a woman who is caught, perhaps set up, in the act of committing adultery. She's dragged into the public square. And she's deposited right in front of Jesus, right in the temple courts, because the scribes and the Pharisees, religious leaders, are trying to put a test to Jesus. One question: pass or fail. There's a whole lot riding on it, though. Maybe even Christ's life or death, because they understand that if he were to condone the stoning of this woman, the execution of this woman, by enforcing the law of Moses, that he would be discrediting himself in the eyes of those who are on the receiving end of such scrutiny and brutality, religious violence. On the other hand, he says, no, 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 let her go. Then he is publicly denying the law of Moses, which opens him up to a charge of heresy, of being a lawbreaker, and he then could be arrested. So they figure, either way, we got him. And as John tells us, Jesus, of course, finds a way out of the predicament by inviting them to do some of their own pondering. Now, the woman who is at the heart of the story, we don't know much about her, do we? Don't know her name. We don't know how old she is. We don't know if she's a mom. We do know she's married. We don't know anything about her ethnicity. We don't know nothing about anything about her except that she has committed this one act. And that one act in her life becomes her identity in this context. We're dealing not with a person, we're dealing with an adulterer here. And what she has done requires all of us to respond. You know, we humans have this propensity to often take a single event or a moment or perhaps a physical or a spiritual characteristic of somebody and decide that becomes really their overarching identity. The thing that's most requiring us somehow to judge, to see. We often make quick judgments about somebody's value, their worth, on things like skin color, certainly still on gender, how they vote, perhaps, what nation they're from, how old they are. Sometimes a single attribute can make you see somebody in a certain way that gives you all you think you need to be able somehow to categorize and to respond to that person. The writer of James in the New Testament was talking about this propensity in the very earliest days of the church to have this ingrained response to deal with people differently based on one attribute. It wasn't about whether they committed adultery, it was about how much affluence they had. So John is taking a look at the practices of the early church, and he writes, suppose a person comes into your meeting wearing a gold ring and fine clothes. And a poor man in filthy old clothes also comes in. If you show special attention to the one wearing fine clothes and say, here's a great seat for you, come on down, we're so glad you're here. But you say to the poor man, you stand there, or sit on the floor by my seat. Have you not discriminated against yourselves, among yourselves, and become judges with evil thoughts? I'm guessing James wrote this because he was aware that in the early church, Christians were practicing the cultural bias, not a bias Christ ever taught. In fact, he taught the opposite. That those who have much, who have many resources, should be treated, are meant to be treated, are used to being treated better than those who have little. Those who come in looking dirty or smelly. We certainly look at homeless people differently than we look at CEOs, for example. And yet James says that when we make this discrimination amongst people in such a way, he says that we have engaged in evil thoughts. It's a pretty stark judgment. Those are evil thoughts, not just unfortunate, but those are thoughts that are evil. Why? Because they are directly in opposition, right, to the way that God thinks. And the way that God thinks is that every person, again, has been infused, created, endowed with incalculable value because I've made them. And nothing that any human being can do can raise that value or lower that value. It is a static number that can't be topped or lowered. We don't have that permission, ability to do that. Every person has that. And yet we are so prone again to deciding, well, maybe the way God set it up needs some fine-tuning, some adjusting. And so we do look often at people with wealth different than poor people, or black people from white people, or men from women, right? Depending on where you're, again, where your nation is from. And sometimes those impulses get baked into not just personal interactions, but into systems, for example, of justice. And so those who have more means usually come out of a justice system issue with a better result than those who don't have money to afford an attorney, for example. It's often the case that we find that certain attributes carry a lot of power as we move through our lives as human beings. An example is in this story, again, we see a bias at work here. Because last time I checked, I'm pretty sure that adultery requires two people. Somebody else was in that room, and they dragged her out of it. But there's no mention of him. He's nowhere to be found. Imagine that. As that old American Express commercial used to say, membership has its privileges. And being a male has had great privileges. In Jesus culture, perhaps even higher levels of patriarchy. So being a man provided a sense of mercy, compassion, exclusion, we're not really concerned about you. You go on your way. Now you, we're taking you with us. And again, they drop her there before Jesus. So these Pharisees and these teachers of the law, these folks who wear the garments of religious professionalism, they're used to being the ones who look out and decide, you have value, you don't. Yes, you, not you. They have this category of sins that they carry around and they enforce to make sure that everybody knows their place in the pecking order at which they are occupying the top rung. And so they feel free to drag this person, embarrass her, humiliate her, to use her in a plot against Jesus. They're not even that concerned about her, probably. They just want to get at Christ, and so they're using her in that regard. And so Jesus skillfully says, well, let's change the perspective here. Let's change the pecking order. What if we were to look not at her from your exalted place? What if you were to look up to the only one who really has the power to judge? What if you were to look towards God and you ask yourself, how are you doing living up to God's standards yourselves? Let's move from her to the Lord. And they stop for a second. They do ponder. They do realize, oh, well, things do look different in that way. They drop their stones and they walk away. And after they walk away, Jesus says to this woman, is no one left to condemn you? No, no one. He says, I don't condemn you either. Now, here's the thing, I want you to go on your way, but do not sin again. In some ways, I think what Christ is saying here is that you were spared a violent death today by people who were going to execute you in a cruel and inhumane way. But to really live the life that God wants you to live, it's not enough that you've been spared from dying today. What you really are invited to do is to live in a way where you stop doing violence to yourself. You can't keep thinking of yourself and acting in ways that are less than how God sees you. The reason that you were in the situation is because you saw yourself not as somebody who was worthy of being treated and living as a daughter of God. Whenever we forget that we are indeed children of God, we become identified, we identify ourselves in some other ways, and we begin to act in ways that are always less than what God intends for us, God longs for us. We begin to act in ways that hurt ourselves and other people in the world. The writer John Deere, in a book called The Nonviolent Life, writes these words. He says, violence is forgetting who we are. I love that. Violence is forgetting who we are. It involves the rejection or forgetting of our ultimate identity, who we are in relation to God. And once we reject who we are, forget who we are, or fail to recognize who we are, we easily do damage to ourselves and others because we have lost ourselves. I love that. We have lost ourselves in the chaos of meaninglessness. I think there's so much truth in that, that violence is forgetting who we are. And once we forget who we are or reject it, or maybe don't even understand it, we begin to act in ways, again, that can create such harm. Because we're always acting from a lesser place, narrower ground. Whenever we act, for example, from a place of, my ego needs to be satisfied. Or I don't like the fact that that person voted that way. Or I am not happy about that or about that. And we begin to make judgments based upon our own smaller self-understandings. Groups that we identify with instead of God. We trade in this sacred endowment of value for something so much less. It's sort of like the Old Testament story where Esau trades in his birthright for a bowl of soup. He trades in his God-given wealth, from inheritance from his father, for something that will just get him through a moment. And he's considered a fool for trading in something of such value for something so much less. And yet, it's so easy to do that. I'm primarily this, I'm primarily that, I'm primarily Republican, I'm primarily a Christian, I'm primarily an American, I'm primarily... And God says, you are so much more than that. You are my son, you are my daughter. I want you to live that way. You'll be happier, the world will be safer. Peace can take place. Jesus kept calling people to a deeper sense of understanding who they are. And the teaching that I know that I repeat over and over again, because for me it's the high watermark of the Christian faith. Jesus says, you've heard it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. I know you've been conditioned to think that way because you think that your primary identity is by being a member of a tribe or a nation. And so you decide, well, these people are my people, so I love them. Those people are not my people. My people hate those people, so I can hate them because I'm primarily this person. I have this identity. And Christ says, no, here's the thing. I want you to love even your enemies. Why? Because that's how God thinks. When you act and think the way God does, then you're actually living in your identity as a son or a daughter of God. He's trying to elevate their understanding of who they are. To let go of the false identities that so easily claim us. Because it's only when we really begin to have the lights go on, oh my God, I'm a child of God. I'm a child of God. And the power of that and the meaning of that begins to infiltrate into our values, into our minds, into our decisions. We begin to then act in ways where God says, yes! That's it. Love that person. Forgive even that person. Pray for that person to persecute you. Why? Because you're my son, you're my daughter, and that's what I do. And that's what you were meant to do, always meant to do. When I first thought of you before I formed the world, you were meant to do that, to live that way. And yet we forget over and over because we live in a world that doesn't believe any of that. Thinks all that is crazy. In our world, we kill our enemies. We malign those we don't agree with. We ridicule those who vote differently. We don't believe any of this culturally, which is why the church has such a hard job to try to find a way to embody this in a world that says, that's not true. None of that's true. If it were true, we would create not a Department of Defense to kill enemies, but a Department trying to teach people how to love enemies. I just can't imagine what that would be like. Let's figure it out. Now we got to slaughter them. So we do. It's the only way we can figure this out. We don't see them. We don't see them. We don't believe that they're children of God. And sometimes we do this to ourselves so easily. I remember one time I was You know, I'm a recovering perfectionist, and I can work myself into a lather of self-condemnation. My inner critic can just sit in a chair and just take out a pound of flesh. And one day, I don't remember what I did, one day I did something and I thought, that was not right, that wasn't good, that was not. And I found myself just letting this inner critic just fill me with self-contempt. And in the middle of this self-contempt frenzy, I heard a voice, you know, or a thought came into my mind. It was from the periphery. And it said, Brian, only I have the power and the right to condemn you. You don't have that right. You didn't make you. You didn't die for you. You're not your Lord. You have no power to do what you're doing. You are condemning something only I have the right to condemn, and I don't condemn you. Stop. I died for you. I was raised for you. I prayed for you. Understand who you are. Understand whose you are. Let go of this need from some smaller place to take on this role and live in my grace and my mercy and my love. And I think every day we wake up, we have to remember, oh, who am I today? Oh yeah, I'm a child of God. And we come here every Sunday and we try to hammer that in. You, this is who you are. And this is who the world needs. The world is dying because people don't know who they are. They don't know who the others are. We run around in a case with horrible cases of mistaken identity. And God says, the church is here to help people to know how much I care for them, how much I love them, that I died for them. Let them know, let them know, let them know who they are, that they might know who I am. And it is to this great God who calls us all to live as God's beloved children that we give all praise and honor and glory today, tomorrow, and indeed forevermore.